Lone Wolf Radio here. Lone Wolf Radio here. This is Lone Wolf Radio, and this is Terrible Tommy at the microphone here on Wotan's Day, David Lane's favorite day, and it is the 27th of the month, going on the end of the year. And I hear it's 4 degrees temperature in Chicago today. Whoa! I'm glad I'm not in Indiana. Whoa! Well, I'm going to run you another little lecture I think we all can use once in a while, and this is a refresher on interrogation and intelligence gathering and so forth, and let's hear it from a so-called expert.
On interview and interrogation, Captain Berger.
Now, with respect to interrogation, this is a painful word to me. As a matter of fact, I demurred very strongly when some friend... indicated that this was my assignment, because this is a word which I would, as an individual at least, like to suggest that you consider dropping from the vocabulary of your particular discipline, occupation, or profession. And the reason that I suggest that is simply this. I ask you to examine your own intellectual response to the word. What is its connotation to you? How do you respond to the word interrogation? As a term, do you give it the kind of response which identifies it with any of the behavioral or social sciences? Do you give it a response that indicates it has any kind of an ethical, humane, sophisticated type of query? Or do you get, as I suspect that I have for many years, a reaction that we are talking about part of the adversary proceedings of law? Now, I'm not here to demean law. Heaven knows it's one of the fundamental educative aspects of the culture. But law is an adversary proceeding. Law is not a search for truth in the scientific sense. We get positions polarized sometimes, and the prevailing position of the plaintiff or the prosecution in the event of a state or governmental actor is to establish their point of view. Now, we call it justice because they establish that point of view according to certain procedures and rules which have been laid down, which means that if you can prevail according to the rules, you have equated that victory with justice. That doesn't necessarily mean that you have per se established the truth. Now, in any kind of a scientific conclave or any confrontation with a problem in science, people join around the table or vis-a-vis their problem in an effort to establish what the truth of the problem is, and not necessarily to establish their hypothesis or postulate to that problem. And therefore, interrogation, which is a legal term when you get right down to it, and one of the things that is really abrasive to me, just as a quasi-spectator now to your field, is to attempt to find in the literature some research, some studies, some assistance. And if you pick up your titles and run through them, look at the bibliographical citations which they offer you, the moment that you find a book or a text which is going to address itself to interrogation or to the law enforcement man or to those who are associated with personnel investigations or disciplinary inquiries, they immediately downgrade their language almost instantaneously you can see the shift in the cerebral presentation, and then they begin to talk about interrogation. Now, I don't mean to, again, become provocative with some very decent men who have written tomes in this field. As good a tome, perhaps, as you can find. I think there are, I happened to be in Washington just this last week, and I checked, went through the library and books in print, and tried to check some of the recent titles. There are no titles that are significantly literary or scholarly in our field. There are about 6 or 7 titles that are redundantly battered back and forth. You pick up any book, read the same sort of paraphrasing, look at the bibliographical citations, and it'll be the same old 6 or 7 tired titles. Now, this is not, again, opprobrious of those efforts, but it's simply that this is a plateau. They achieved this plateau as far back, frankly, as Larson's book lying in I think it's called lie detection, as simple as that. Larson actually is a scholar. As you may know, Larson is the obscure member of the Keeter-Larson team. Larson was the educated member of the team, had his PhD and his MD from Berkeley, and was professor of psychiatry at the University of Indiana. Larson wrote an extraordinarily insightful and scholarly book on lie detection, which was not necessarily oriented to the mechanistic approach of teaching a man how to use a machine. And I say this, you know, with the appropriate concern, because that essentially was my entry skill into law enforcement, if you can use the word skill in that frame of reference. 20th century version of the rubber hose. You have in the literature, of our literature, very little material that would help us today when the rest of the world is moving forward. So I would ask you to do this. If you could even embrace the concept which the moderator used and the previous speaker used, I noticed, interviewing, which is an entirely different concept in this world. Interviewing is an aspect of the social behavioral sciences. A variety of true professional disciplines are engaged in interviewing. And as is characteristic of such disciplines, they did an enormous amount of research. They have made many studies as to what constitutes effective, reasonable, sophisticated, if you were, and socially acceptable methods. Now, for instance, one little book, Bigham, Moore, Gustad, it's a Harper book, not current but recent, had at the end of the first chapter 63 bibliographic citations. Chapter 2 had 73 citations. It's a 14-chapter book. And in this book were listed studies, Schultz study, the Otto study, the study at Wisconsin, the study at Northwestern, the study of the behavioral and social scientists who have taken the responsibility and the challenge of interviewing as one to which they were not familiar and with which they had some curiosity as to what would constitute a good technique, a good method. And interestingly enough, they learned that the kind of information and advice which our field in interrogation has been given did not stand up under inquiry. For instance, to put it in a pithily, the least significant aspect of an interview is technique and strategy. They found this had no correlation whatsoever with the success of an interview. Now, very recently, within the last 6 months, UCLA, the Institute of Psychiatry there, and a research has confirmed the same thing. They did a research which was embarrassing to them. They found that there was really no efficacy at all in the psychiatric technique, in the therapeutic psychiatric dialogue interview. They found that the sine qua non, the indispensable element requisite to a successful interview, is the relationship that the interviewer can develop with the interviewee. And that the relationship is in toto the denominator which suggests and portends how this interview will go. Now, this is an aspect that you can almost assume is foreclosed from an interrogation. If you approach the dialogue or the communicative process that you contemplate as an interrogation, you have almost prostituted the possibility of developing the relationship, quote, that is essential to success in that dialogue. So that, without necessarily laboring the point, and certainly not, and this is not a diatribe on semantics, but it does seem to me that we have long since come to the point where we do not have to be saddled with connotative terms like interrogation, which has, I believe, a very, very critical implication. I would like to read you a number, just a few, observations which have evolved from some recent research done by the behavioral scientists on interviewing. One, and I mentioned it, the essential element of the relationship is not technique, not tactic, not strategy, not organizing your room, not ridding the walls of pictures. May I ask you something? We talk about a non-distracting room. I don't know how many times I've read that in various tomes directed to us. What could be more distracting than a room with nothing in it? Now, I mean, this is just simple logic. You walk into a modern law enforcement building or a security office, and the planner and the architect and the chief special agents have put their heads together and have read the tomes and have said, well, now we want to have this a very non-distracting room. So we'll have no wall pictures, we'll have no lamps, we'll have no furnishings, we'll have two chairs and a desk, and we will bring our subject in, and of course he will immediately feel at ease because there will be nothing about this room to distract him. Nothing except the room. That's all. The total room. Now, we're wiser than that. We have to be wiser than that. This may have been a step forward from a cell. Yes, I agree. I mean, my first office with the Los Angeles Police Department was in an abandoned cell on the second floor of the old Central Police Station. And I wouldn't have to agree that with any of the writers that a stark, Spartan office would have been preferable to that. But it would have been hardly ideal, and I would certainly not have expected it to be the product of planning between architects and builders and chief special agents. Now, this element of relationship, I don't mean to entertain you, but I would like to tell you a quick story that occurred in L.A. because it involves two very significant people, I think, and men who are in our business, and particularly in the law enforcement phase of it, who have the natural quality of establishing a relationship. Some years ago, there was an extraordinarily complicated homicide. The ultimate victim, the genesis of his demise, was Beverly Hills. He was a wealthy man, had properties up and down the coast. I would gather that he enjoyed responding to little problems that these properties posed. It gave him a chance to leave home, stay away for a few days, ostensibly on business. It was generally recognized that he enjoyed himself while away. Down in one of the coastal cities that had, among other things, a motel which he owned, a very well-known name in California history, who was a scion of a family with lots of money, but this was a sort of a remittance man who had disqualified himself. He was living in a motel. He was tendering bad checks to the motel owner, and he was romancing a very attractive young gal that he had met in Phoenix or someplace and brought her up to La Jolla, Laguna areas. So the ultimate victim responded to the notice from his management that the management was holding several hundred dollars worth of bad checks by going down there and having two or three days of interviewing with the suspect. And he and the suspect were competing for the girl by the end of this week. And the suspect, out of a number of dynamics which we needn't concern ourselves with, killed the man. Drove him out in the hills in the victim's own car, Lincoln Continental, shot and killed him, and took $2,000 or $3,000 in currency from the body, put the body in the trunk of the victim's car, drove it to Norm's Landing, I believe it was in Newport Beach, was affluent enough now to take a cab back to Laguna, and went on for a day or two of entertaining with the young lady, and then certain aspects of law enforcement began to get into the act. The missing persons from Beverly Hills, you know, noticed down in the Laguna area, they had been seen, and then the check with a wireless outfit, the Western Union, and finally we got a lead on the man, and he was picked up, and somehow or other, they picked him up in Los Angeles. They brought him into my office for interviewing. Now, in our office at that time, we had five or six highly educated young men. Everything is relative. There are no absolutes. Even in education, we were relatively highly educated young men. And we had all the modern gimmicks, and we had several polygraphically oriented specialists, and we had a couple of white-collar men, and we had men with manicured nails, and we had all of the assets that are presumed to be preparation and equipment for meeting, confronting, as it were, a gentleman. Gentleman, check writer, murderer, but nevertheless gentleman. And we spent hours. I only can say sparring with this man. He was educated, he was well trained, he had never had a job in his life, but he had lived very well, been indemnified and subsidized by a very wealthy family. And we went on and on and on, using all the ploys, all the techniques, all the tricks, all the tactics, all the books, everything the encyclopedia can suggest to you. Now, Tad Brown was chief of detectives, and Hugh Farnham was his inspector. And here's a couple of old pros. I'm sure that Brown was getting impatient. He was in the listening post, I guess that's the euphemistic description for this term. He was a cat at the mouth hole, as it were. Finally, in an appropriate interruption, he knocked on the door and smiled. Didn't know what an amiable guy he is anyway. And by this time, we were on the third shift with this fellow, and I guess I was in there, and this must have been more banal than ever, because Brown couldn't stand it another minute. So he came in, introduced himself, and he asked me if I objected if he asked the man a question. I said no. I took my cue and went through the big privacy routine, you know, and exited and all. Brown sat down, sat across from this chap, and here's what he said to him. He introduced himself, and he said, I know you, and I know your background, and I recognize that you're a gentleman. I want to ask you to do me a favor. Out in the hall, there are representatives from four jurisdictions waiting to determine whose problem this is. Now, this was on a Sunday morning. He says, you know, this is the Sabbath day. These guys are all away from home. Three of them have probably no province in this case. It's not their case. All I'm asking you to do is do me just courtesy. Whose case is it? And the fellow said, well, I think it belongs in Laguna, whatever that is, what county that is. Oh, that very much. Thank you very much. That helps us a great deal. This was the first statement this man had made that associated himself with that case. So nothing sophisticated. You know what this derives from? Derives from the fact that a man like Brown is real, you see. There's a natural quality to Brown, and he was intuitively, and has been for many years, just as Farnham did, just as Jack Donahue did, just incidentally as their new chief has a lot of this quality in him. They are so real that they get this relationship, which the social scientists and the behavioral scientists now say is necessary. Now, this wasn't something that Brown had devised. He hadn't rehearsed it at home. He hadn't said to his wife in the mornings, you know, help me get the attitude. Because he is just fundamentally so real that he develops this relationship as some of the other men. And that is why it seems to me, and retrospectively at least, and looking back on the success of some of these men, we have mis-evaluated, misunderstood why they were successful. We assumed, I believe, that they had tactics, techniques, that they were bright, alert, you know, they could spot a lie and they knew how to attack it. And I don't believe that's the case anymore. I believe that the social scientists have demonstrated rather persuasively, if not conclusively, that this is the distinction that they have. These men develop the relationship. Let me quickly give you some notions which the behavioral scientists in recent studies have suggested to us. Things which I don't believe we have truly learned from our own literature. One, the free narrative, while less comprehensive, is considerably more accurate than any other form of interviewing. The free narrative. Now, we've badgered this thing back and forth in law enforcement and in the disciplinary sciences for years. No one has ever known. One's advocated one, one's advocated another. They have studied it. Thousands of cases, ascertained which is the more accurate, or the most in this instance, because there are many ways. The free narrative, less comprehensive, but more accurate. More accurate. Agreement on detail by a number of people who witness the situation does not substantiate that detail. This alone does not substantiate the detail. Human beings are subject to common errors, and any scientific evaluation of information has to recognize that many people can make the same error. So that our past, our history of assuming that simply because we have a majority who saw the situation or the event in the same perceptive light, the same perceptual responses, does not necessarily confirm that fact. The report that is made immediately following an event is not necessarily the best report. Now, this is something we've always talked about hot interrogations and hot impressions, and get the report immediately before these facts fade from the mind. And this somewhat ingenuous, apparently, curiosity we have. Their researchers indicate that immediate reports are not necessarily better. Now, I'm not going to go into and elaborate on these. They're all in the literature today, and a bibliographical list could be made available to you. There's what's called an economy of consciousness that operates in most human beings, and it explains, incidentally, the tendency for an individual to elaborate on a case logically. He fills in the gaps. It's not accurate. Certain accurate information comes, and there are certain natural gaps. His pattern of life is not one. None of us have the kind of pattern, apparently, or not enough of us, that allows him to report gap information. He fills in the gaps. Unconsciously, most of the time. And it's logical to fill in, because it's his logic, but it may or may not be accurate according to the study. Confessions, the mechanism of confession, is now seen to be prompted by, animated almost exclusively by, the element of rapport in the meeting. Nothing else. But the good guy and the bad guy. Pardon me. The urging of frankness in an interview inhibits frankness. Studies of thousands of interviews indicate that where you urge the subject to be frank and honest, you in effect inhibit frankness and honesty. Frankness and honesty are stimulated essentially by an atmosphere of frankness and honesty. I think one of the things that characterizes guys like Brown is that you get the impression that you're doing business with an honest man. That if he's after you, he's going to tell you so. But there's no animosity in it, and there's no hate in it. It's just a job, and this is as objective as a human being can be with a painful responsibility. That's to find out the truth of this matter. Spontaneity, well, I think most of us recognize this. Spontaneity is probably the most effective response, and it can only be achieved in an informal kind of an interview. Descriptions of persons are seldom accurate. They studied thousands of depositions. One half of 1% of them were accurate. Without error. One half of 1%. The implicative question is the poorest question you can ask. An implicative question, for instance, would be, was he a dark-haired man? You've already implicated that he's dark-haired to the extent you've selected this hair out from other colors instead of saying, what color hair did he have? The best question is to eliminate what's called a definite article. For instance, did you see a gun, not the gun? The moment you say, did you see the gun, you have triggered what is called unconscious accommodation. And man immediately wants to, if possible, find some place in his memory center, some awareness of having seen the gun, because as far as he's concerned, there was the gun. When you say, did you see a gun, you at least open the possibility for him answering within the frame of reference of his own knowledge. Attestation, or what's called the religious oath, on my honor, as God is my judge. We've always assumed this was a sign, for instance, of deception. It turns out that these relative oaths reduce error. Most people who use these actually are somewhat more accurate than people who do not. Now, there are some overriding aspects of this, which we won't labor this morning, but Schuyler, as a matter of fact, way back in 1936, had a theory about this. In properly conducted and solicited information interviews, about the best score you can expect is 75% accuracy. That seems to be about the human quantum for accuracy. Now, I have quite a long list of what's called memorability phenomenon, things that they remember best, such as in this order, I'll just give you one segment. People remember things better than anything else, presence of things, the numbers of people present, if that number is small, space relations, next, conditions of objects present, next, order of events, next, color of the surroundings or milieu, next, the size and quantity of objects, next, the sounds, next to last, and the time duration is the least accurate of all human impressions. Now, these are just offered as samples of the kinds of materials which the behavioral scientists have given us. In summary, let me suggest to you that an interview, which is a purposeful communication, a dialogue with a meaning and a purpose, is apparently best conducted under a relationship which is sound, ethical, rather than tactical, humane, perhaps, unless you want to, not the bleeding heart humaneness, but the fact of Stuckenbecker and Shakespeare's quality of mercy, you know. It isn't justice they were looking for, my Lord, but to mercy. You know, were it justice, we'd all be in trouble. See, there's no salvation, as the Merchant of Venice was prone to say. Thank you.
Our next speaker comes to us from Chicago. Distinguished gentleman, has had a background in polygraph work for a great many years. He's associate director and legal counsel of the John E. Reed and Associates Company, a firm engaged exclusively in the administration of polygraph examinations and written examinations for the assessment of attitude toward honesty of persons applying for positions of trust. Mr. Lindbergh joined the firm while attending school at Northwestern University, where he majored in law. Since becoming a member of the Illinois Bar, he's remained with the firm in the capacity of legal counsel and associate director. George Lindbergh has personally conducted over 5,000 polygraph examinations involving every type of personnel and criminal investigation. He's assisted Professor Fred E. Inbow of Northwestern University and John Reed in the preparation of their publications, including Criminal Interrogation and Confessions, which was published in 62, Truth and Deception, the Polygraph Lie Detector Techniques, published in 1966. A man who has had a great deal of experience lecturing at universities, both here in the United States and in Australia, Mr. Lindbergh has conducted polygraph examinations and demonstrations in Australia, South Africa, and other areas of the world. He's a member of the Illinois State Bar Association, the American Academy of Forensic Sciences, the American Polygraph Association, and the Special Agents Association. He was recently elected to the General Assembly of Illinois as a state representative and has been appointed to the Illinois Crime Investigating Commission. Would you join me in welcoming to our podium this morning Mr. George Lindbergh on the truth about lie detection?
Thanks very much. We're gathered here today to discuss the problems and suggest solutions that relate to the increasingly difficult problem of maintaining the security of personnel and property in business and industry. The problems are indeed great, and there is every indication that they will become more serious as the years go on. We may speculate as to the reasons for this increase. It's been suggested that it can be attributed to a decline in the morality of people generally. It has also been suggested that modern methods of manufacturing and marketing have greatly increased the opportunity for theft, or economic espionage, or sabotage, or the other related problems. It might also be suggested that the coddling of the criminal attitude of the Supreme Court, which pervades our entire judicial system, therefore, has resulted in the immunization of criminals from detection and prosecution, thus contributing to the overall population of criminals in our society. I do not purport to be an authority on these difficult questions. The purpose of my appearance before you today is to suggest a solution which I believe is uniquely versatile. My topic is the use of the polygraph technique as a method of security in business and industrial establishments. It is my hope that in some small way what I will say here will assist you in making decisions as to whether or not the polygraph is an effective and desirable method of investigation for the myriad of problems that confront security directors throughout the world. Now, part of the cutting that I have engaged in includes a historical background of the polygraph, and this is going to be handled at the Polygraph Theater this afternoon, and also a description of the instrumentation. And I feel that all of you men, being in security, are sufficiently sophisticated in the workings of the polygraph that I won't go into the detail of instrumentation. The title of my topic is The Truth About the Polygraph. And the truth does include a specific and technical description of what's involved in a polygraph test. But I will leave the evaluation of instrumentation and so forth to the Polygraph Theater, and I'll go right into the technique of administering a test. Now, I must acknowledge that I am purposely being technical. This doesn't make for the type of speech that is entertaining, but I don't mean to entertain. I mean to impart as much technical information as I can. A polygraph instrument, regardless of how sophisticated or how sensitive, would be useless without an appropriate technique for the administration of the polygraph examinations. The technique must be capable of providing the examiner with physiological data upon which he may determine whether a subject is under significantly greater stress in his answers to relevant questions in comparison with his answers to other questions on the test. There are basically three types of questions in a polygraph examination. The first form of question is what is referred to as a known truth question, wherein the subject is asked in a standard polygraph test four questions to which the examiner knows he is answering truthfully. The examiner uses these questions to determine the subject's physiological pattern during periods of truth-telling. Now, you've heard people say, boy, if I had to take a polygraph test or a lie detector test in common parlance, that thing would no doubt explode or ring the bell and so forth. Well, of course, there's some truth in this. The polygraph environment is different than the environment in your living room or in your office, and it does increase the person's emotional stress. So therefore, we must determine how this subject responds when he's answering truthfully, and when we use that as our standard basis of comparison. The second form of question is the known deception questions. There are usually two such questions in each test, and the purpose of these questions is to ascertain a reflection of the subject's physiological activity when he answers questions deceptively. The subject's patterns for known truth and known deception are then compared with his patterns when he answers the third classification of questions, namely the specific issue questions. These, of course, are the critical questions. They are usually four in each test, and this would complete the questioning protocol of about 10 questions per test. Now, techniques vary somewhat, but this is the one that's recommended in Reed and Inbo's text, Truth and Deception. So there are 10 questions, four known truth, four specific issue, and two control or known deception questions. The questions are prepared with the subject during the pretest interview, which is the most important aspect of a polygraph examination. Again, the examiner uses a rather rigid questioning pattern during the pretest interview, which is designed to elicit the maximum amount of information which the subject is willing to impart to the examiner. Additionally, the pretest interview serves the function of providing the examiner an opportunity to observe the subject's demeanor in much the same way that the physician conducts his interview with the patient for the purpose of obtaining information on symptoms or characteristics which would relate to a disease. A similar situation arises in our jury system, where a judge and the jury have as their function the observing of the demeanor of the witnesses. During the pretest interview, in the specific issue case, the examiner will obtain information regarding the subject's employment history, some of his family history, and voluntary information regarding the subject's criminal background, if any. More specifically, however, his purpose is to obtain from the subject as much information as possible as to whether he committed the crime or whether he knows who committed the crime and other information which may be in his possession. It is during the interview, which usually requires 30 to 40 minutes, that the examiner conditions the subject for the polygraph examination. The conditioning consists in most cases of relieving the subject of unnecessary emotional concern over the examination. Most people feel that an examiner has a function of stimulating a subject or getting them confused as the attorney does on cross-examination. And of course, the opposite is the case. We try to turn down his emotional concern as much as possible before beginning with the tests themselves. This is established in no small degree by the fact that the examiner rehearses the entire examination procedure with the subject until he is confident that the subject is fully apprised of the entire procedure. The examiner then advises the subject that the polygraph tests themselves will take place and that they will be five in number. Again, there's a certain variance between techniques. The blood pressure cuff is inflated, and the examiner begins asking the questions at about 12-second intervals. During the asking of each question, approximately four respiratory cycles are completed, together with about 15 blood pressure pulse cycles. Each polygraph test requires 2.5 to 3 minutes. Between each test period, the examiner permits the subject to move and make himself more comfortable while the blood pressure cuff pressure is at the zero level. Each succeeding test is somewhat different than the preceding test in that the examiner injects a different form of conditioning prior to each test. The conditioning procedure is quite sophisticated and therefore difficult to explain without going into extensive detail. However, the purpose of the conditioning is to enhance the polygraph records or data so that the truthful subject is more easily determined as such, while the deceptive subject is induced to display his deception more dramatically. Five separate tests are conducted so as to eliminate error, which may result from a random physiological reaction, and also for the purpose of taking advantage of the reliability provided by a multi-test examination. That is a capsule view of technique. From its inception, the polygraph technique was inseparably related to the field of interrogation. In fact, the polygraph technique is frequently referred to as instrumental interrogation. It was perhaps natural and necessary that the polygraph technique evolved in this manner. I would like to suggest, however, that the polygraph technique has now developed to the point where it can stand as a field apart from interrogation. Polygraph examinations can be conducted and are conducted by examiners using modern techniques without any of the traditional earmarks of conventional interrogative procedures. A properly conducted polygraph examination does not have as its objective the admission or confession of the subject to the crime under investigation. Rather, it has a diagnostic purpose, that is, an accurate assessment of the subject's truth or deception to the crime issue questions. As an illustration, in our Chicago laboratory, only about 25% of the specific issue cases result in a diagnosis of deception on the part of the subject. 70% are reported as truthful, and approximately 5% are reported as inconclusive or indeterminate. Therefore, the opportunity for productive interrogation exists only in the 25% who are reported as deceptive. For several reasons, including the fact that many of the subjects are the clients of attorneys or have been sent in by judges, interrogation subsequent to the polygraph examination is not requested. Of the subjects that are reported deceptive, at 25%, approximately 60% are interrogated for the purpose of eliciting a confession. And again, of this number, about 60% confess. Thus, in 1 year's time, in our laboratory, approximately 750 out of 3,000 specific issue subjects are reported as deceptive. Of this number, 450 were interrogated, and approximately 270 confessed. This would seem to me to be strong evidence of the very, very limited relationship between interrogation and the polygraph technique. Many people are surprised when they study these statistics and find that 70% of the total number of subjects tested were reported as truthful. However, when it's realized that 10, 20, 50, or perhaps 100 subjects were tested in a specific case in which only one subject was guilty, the statistics seem more meaningful. Now, as to the types of tests that are available and that are conducted in business and industry, the polygraph examination is used in three areas in the modern business community. The first is the use of the polygraph to screen applicants for positions of trust. The second is the use of the polygraph as a method of continuing security by the periodic testing of employees in sensitive work. The third area is the use of the polygraph as an investigative aid after the employment crime has been committed. In our laboratory, we conduct approximately 2,000 applicant examinations each year. The polygraph provides a unique investigative facility in this regard. The theory behind the polygraph screening of applicants is the premise that a person who has engaged in thefts from previous employers or has established a pattern of continuing antisocial conduct will, for all practical purposes, continue to exhibit that conduct with a new employer. There's a law in physics, a law of momentum, which says that a body at rest tends to remain at rest and one at motion tends to continue in motion. This is also true in behavioral momentum. A person who has established a pattern of theft will continue to exhibit that pattern of theft, and the purpose of the pre-employment polygraph test is to determine whether or not that pattern exists, and if so, to reject the employee, the applicant. Also, when you recognize that 70% of the crimes, according to the FBI, are committed by people between the ages of 16 and 25 years old, which also represents the group that is seeking employment and becoming employed in our business world, you realize the tremendous problem of screening people before they become employed. Traditionally, employers use techniques such as requiring references from former employers or from relatives of the applicant, and some conduct retail credit checks and possibly police record searches. Regrettably, none of these sources of information can be relied on for accurate information as to honesty. It has been estimated that approximately only 5% of the persons who commit crimes are recorded as such in police files. This is particularly true in the area of employment theft, where most commonly the crime is not reported to the police, and in many cases not even reported to the insurance company. Therefore, the chances are approximately 1 in 20 that adverse information will be contained in the police records, which are generally not available anyway. Financial stability is not a sine qua non for honesty, and for that reason, retail credit information is of little value in assessing integrity. Contact with relatives or family of the applicant is equally unreliable for the reason that this information is especially prejudiced and most commonly in favor of the applicant. Now, in our pre-employment program, we have, in addition to the polygraph test, we have a written examination which is called the Reed Report, which I have here, and it contains much of the information which the previous speakers have alluded to as far as completeness is concerned. It's extremely detailed. It's the product of 25 years research, and the applicants complete this booklet, and then they are given a polygraph test. However, the booklet is also available on the basis of no polygraph test, and we found a virtually one-for-one ratio as far as the accuracy of one compared to the other. In our applicant testing program, we are aided by the written examination, which precedes the polygraph test. It's called the Reed Report, and its concept was developed by John E. Reed while he was the chief examiner at the Chicago Police Scientific Crime Detection Laboratory between 1940 and 47. After going into private practice, Mr. Reed developed the Reed Report to the point that we are now marketing it without reference to a polygraph examination. The principal function of the Reed Report, however, is the evaluation of the subject's attitude toward honesty. This is accomplished by the use of approximately 100 questions which the subject must answer with yes or no. These questions have been developed over 25 years and are designed to reflect the subject's basic attitude with regard to dishonesty. His answers are scored and given individual weights, which are then computed in the overall score. Additionally, the Reed Report provides information regarding the subject's armed service history, medical history, financial history, and his present financial status. This information is supplemented by a very thorough interrogatory on the degree to which the subject has participated in various types of crimes. The Reed Report is a unique pre-employment tool because it has been validated by an unusually effective way. During its early development, the Reed Report was completed by the applicant, and then he was immediately given a polygraph examination, which permitted us to determine the relationship between his Reed Report score and the final results of the polygraph examination. While in the earlier years there was some disparity between the results, several additions have now resulted in a correlation factor of upwards of 90% between the results of the polygraph examination and the results of the Reed Report. Now, I think this next part is quite important because it brings together remarks that have been made by each of the preceding speakers. And what I'm going to tell you now is what we've learned about honesty, and make it very simple, and when you go back home, you'll know all the answers. By conducting over 20,000 pre-employment polygraph and Reed Report examinations has indicated to us that approximately 30% of the population has an attitude that simply will not tolerate dishonesty in the area of theft. Indeed, it would be a most desirable situation if it were possible to employ only that 30%. The economics of the employment market, however, are such that an additional 40% are permitted to obtain positions of trust with but a reasonable degree of risk. The character of the persons in the 40% group are such that with reasonable security precautions, they will not become involved in dishonest acts such as theft. The final 30%, however, will actually create an opportunity to engage in theft. It is this group that the Reed Report is designed to eliminate from consideration for employment and positions of trust. There are basically three factors, from our experience, involved in theft. Opportunity to steal without getting caught. This is, of course, the function of the security director, is to reduce the opportunity to a nullity. Second is need. Low wages are an example. Unfavorable associations, which are expensive, are another example of need. And this is the explanation why you study a man's financial status as closely as possible. And finally, the most important one, and has been mentioned here by almost every speaker, is attitude. Does the person have an attitude which condones theft or opposes theft? And these are the three criteria that we have worked so diligently on in developing the Reed Report. Well, I've covered a vast number of topics, and I didn't get a chance to tell any stories, but my time is up, and I'll thank you very much.
Well, there's several different machines available now, have been for some time. I've seen most of them, seen several of them in action. And I used to operate the B&W machine, which is one of the original machines, and to be perfectly honest, worked best without all the side issues. I was somewhat successful in using the lie detector. Stress analyzer is what it really is. It's not a lie detector. It just gives you the readings that shows that the person is highly agitated when you ask them a certain question. And through an intricate formula, gives you the idea whether they had guilty knowledge or guilty. And it's a very simple situation. The basic part of the machine, of that machine, was galvanic response, which is nothing more than an ohmmeter, similar to what the Scientologists use, only they don't use they don't use algorithms and things and formulas to figure it out. They just use their own whacked out idea. But one of these Scientologists, money raisers, talks you into putting you on their meter. It's a con, it's a joke, it's meaningless. Well, nothing's totally meaningless, but it's a con. The whole Scientology is just another church con. But I'm not going to go into that. I'm not going to go into my work with David McCollum exposing Scientology either. Poor David's dead. He was a good man. I first came upon the lie detector equipment when I went to a national right-wing anti-communist convention back in Norborn, Missouri, headed up by Robert Depew, the leader of the Minutemen. And at this meeting, I met Robert Shelton, head of the United Clans of America. At the time, he was traveling around in a big recreational vehicle. He invited me in. I went in, and he showed me his lie detection equipment, which is the same thing I later purchased for myself. And he was telling me some interesting stories, and I related to him to you on here several times, I think. Some funny stories that Shelton had to tell about using the lie detector test and machine. But you got to remember that lie detector is at best, the highest rating I could give it is 94% correct. Well, that sounds pretty good, but that means 5% of the people that you say are guilty may be innocent. It may mean their life. Or the courts or anybody else. I mean, 5% that may show guilt are actually innocent. So that sort of disturbed me for a while. It gradually got me to the point where I said, I don't think I want to use this, because if things really did get hairy and you had to use violence, here you'd be testing people and condemning 5% of the people and that were innocent. 5% may not mean much to you, but 5% to the 5% is 100%. How I came about association with Robert Shelton was that during the Watts riots, a lot of us right-wingers were cross-pollinating and running into each other. And even though I was never a member of the Minutemen, I knew a few Minutemen who were giving me little bits of information. So that was my initial contact with Robert Shelton. Then when he tried to fund his organization by robbing banks, which seemed like a good idea at the time, but it didn't work out too well, and he went to prison for, I think it was 10 years. I used to send him things in prison, send him money, and I remember one time I think he needed some shoes. We got him shoes. And we did that to a lot of POWs, which is something I don't think the general right wing ever does, and I'm not even going to ask him. Robert Shelton was not a racist, at least he told me in his kitchen. At the kitchen table, he wasn't a racist. He wasn't a white separatist. He was an anti-communist. And 90% of the activity he was into was getting ready for the Russian invasion, which I think he should have been getting ready for other invasions, the Mexican invasion. But a lot of time and money and a lot of weaponry was stashed all over the, well, out here in the, I know it's stashed out here in the desert because they've been kicking up weapons for 30, 40 years in the desert that somebody had buried. And probably William P. Gale, Colonel William P. Gale probably buried a lot of it. I don't have any idea. Not my business. I know nothing. Anyhow, I found that probably a better way to determine guilt is to do footwork and investigation on the people or the person you're interested in. You got to pull the files, criminal files and misdemeanor files, civil files, and you have to do the legwork to go down to the courthouse and do it. And most of the time, you can find out a lot about somebody. I mean, and really can that they've been involved in some nasty material. That's how we uncovered Douglas K. Seymour in San Diego, who had joined our Klan, and we found out who he was working for the cops on the payrolls of San Diego policemen. But rather than jump up and down and scream and smack him in the nose, we kept him in. We bled him for money and goods and equipment and vehicles. He did us a lot of good, and I still got to thank the taxpayers of San Diego City and County for financing us. In fact, helping me get on the ballot to run for Congress on the Democrat ticket. If it hadn't been for that cop, I would have never made it to get on the ticket. Because he was working with the Republican Party, and all the people that he was working with were telling him to blow a lot of smoke up my butt and tell me anything I wanted to hear and give me anything I wanted, including catered parties with the best booze and everything. Yeah. What did that informant get? Well, his wife divorced him. He had a mental breakdown, ended up in a mental hospital, lost his business, ended up leaving town and up in Minnesota, I think. I never followed up on it. You know, this Tucker Carlson on Fox TV, I sort of got a kick out of the guy because once in a while he'd say something pretty good. But the whole Fox thing is certainly turned away from us if it ever was any part of us. So anyhow, he's been picking on Russia TV lately. He really bad-mouthed them bad a few nights ago. So, Tucker Carlson, you're out of here. Suppose you heard about this, that this, what's her name, Stein, that ran for the presidency on one of the minor tickets, and she was found to have been in Moscow setting at big dinners with the Russian leaders. And you don't hear much about that on the news, do you? Not at all. Did the military-industrial complex of this country drop bacteriological warfare on North Korea during the Korean War? Now, this was a big thing during the war, and they brought out GIs who confessed to dropping that stuff and using that stuff. And, of course, all us anti-communists poo-pooed it all the way through that, oh, that couldn't possibly be true. Our government wouldn't do something like that. But since all this time and water's passed under the bridge, I'm convinced that a lot of this stuff did happen. And it's interesting that North Korea hates the United States so bad. But if, in fact, it really happened, and we did use germ warfare on North Korea during the Korean War, well, that might give you a reason why they hate our guts. That was back in the days when we thought our government was so wonderful and pure and made a few mistakes once in a while, but basically good. But the more and more we dig out the history and the annals of history, we find that the government of the United States has been criminal in many ways, big ways, for a long time. And to go along with that comment, you should watch this movie, Wormwood. It's on Netflix, I believe, or Hulu, and it details how we and scientists in this country developed chemical warfare and LSD and all that kind of stuff and used it on people and they didn't know it, caused people to commit suicide and all kinds of stuff like that. Also, there's some stuff about how the men had developed an NSA, the ability they would have known about what was going on with the Twin Towers. But they were taken off the project. The project was taken away from them before the towers dropped. But we had all the information. We had all the ability to have found these people out and got them. So it was an inside job. Even if it wasn't planned that way, it turned out to be an inside job. That was a movie, too, called A Good American. You need to watch that one, too. It won't kill you to watch a movie once in a while, because a lot of times there's the writers are putting some pretty good stuff in there. And this new movie coming out about the Washington Post. And I know they're a bunch of flaming progressives, but however, one thing, you can't throw the baby out with the bathwater. During that period of time when millions of people in the Asia were being killed and thousands of American troops were being killed, blown up in the whole bit, Daniel Ellsberg, a Jew, he released these Pentagon papers that he'd gotten a hold of, which shortened the war quite a bit, which saved a hell of a lot of lives. So as right-wingers back then when this was all going on, saying, oh, we hate those people, they're horrible. Well, people don't always do horrible things, and to release the Pentagon Papers was a good thing. Even you can say it was a righteous Jew. I'm not backing up the other things that the Post did. However, on the Nixon thing, I think they did correctly. Nixon was guilty, so he had to pay the price. No matter how much finagling, the right wing can't straighten it out. They can't make it straight. He was a crook. He did bad things. And he wasn't on the white working class side either. Remember the story about this cardinal in Boston? What the hell was his name? I had it written down here someplace, but my desk is so covered up with crap I can't find it. And he beat the law, but he didn't go to jail for child molesting and that he was allowing to happen throughout his churches and all his cathedrals. Well, he jumped and went to Rome to live out his life, and he just died the other day in Rome. But an interesting sidelight on that, up until the, I think it was mid-70s, maybe up into the 80s, there really wasn't much going on about exposing pedophilia and all that kind of stuff. But I had a couple of supporters, good old boys, that lived near me in San Diego County. They used to invite me down for a drink or sandwich once in a while, maybe give me a couple of bucks. And they were good friends of Willis Carto, the leader of Liberty Lobby and the Spotlight newspaper. Well, you hear me sometimes giving Willis hell, but he didn't do all bad. He did good too. And so I was privy to some conversations that went on there early on where they were rallying their forces to go after these homosexual priests or pedophile priests. And they were getting really in tune and going, but they were having a rough time because the church was so strong. But they used to talk about it openly, what they were doing and trying to do. So I would credit at least these two guys and Cardo's machine for really getting the ball going of exposing these Catholic priests in these churches. And I don't think there are too many people know that, so you know it now. Now everybody who was privy at those meetings, except myself, are dead. So you're getting it from me, and that's the last you'll get it from. That's it for today, boys and girls. I'll be back tomorrow on Thursday, and you have a nice day. And let all that stuff sink in about interrogation and interviews and all of that kind of stuff. Because someday, when you least expect it, you're on candid camera. And then you're going to be a victim. and you got to remember the basics. 14 words. Don't talk. Don't talk. If they take you into a cell or a office or wherever, or a squad car, I have nothing to say. That's the only protection you've really got. They'll threaten you. They'll cuss you. They'll tell you you're going to go to jail and never get out. And they'll, because cops can lie, legally cops can lie to you. Yeah, they can tell you anything they want. They can promote any story they want to tell. And many people fall for it. I mean, I almost feel sorry for a lot of these blacks that get in there, and the way they toss them around and break them down so easily. When that'd be funny if all of a sudden all the blacks arrested would say, "I have nothing to say." I'd love it.